So what I would like to talk about this morning are two things that are related, and a little bit the topic of healing, and the other is a topic of mindfulness of breathing. And I'd like to argue or explain or that breathing mindfully, breathing with awareness, breathing, being present for our breath, is a phenomenally healing activity. And that the practice of mindfulness, breathing, is very, very useful, because all these different aspects of ourselves that are fractured, that are injured, that are scarred, that are distressed, that are afraid, can in some remarkable way be healed through something as simple as turning our attention to our breathing. And there are many reasons to be distressed, many reasons why the psyche, the heart, the mind are... I feel injured or hurt or afraid or angry. And there's personal reasons and international reasons, many reasons. And someone who does sit in meditation and tries a little bit to be quiet and be with their breath will very quickly, I believe, discover the degrees to which their mind is fractured, or the degree to which the mind is, the heart is in pain, or the degree to which we're separated from ourselves, the degree to which there's kind of sometimes a centrifugal force that takes us away from ourselves, takes us away from really being settled and at home in this body and mind. And healing in the context of a spiritual life, I imagine, means that a person feels deeply at home in this psyche, in this body and mind, where at least this body and mind complex is not at war with itself, is not afraid of itself, is not spinning out of control in such a way that we can become alienated from ourselves. And from the work of Stephen Levine, we have the idea that healing, that he worked for hundreds of people who are dying of cancer and many things. And he observed that some people who became healed in the course of their illness, the terminal illness, still died. And then his question was, what does it mean to be healed if the illness still has a terminal outcome? And I've seen that. I've seen people who are dying and seen remarkable inner healings in the midst of inevitable death. And sometimes even the inevitability of death, when there's no hope possible, is sometimes the only thing that gives a person the courage or the catalyst or the possibility of letting go fully or really facing fully something that they've been unwilling to do as long as they were, thought they had lots of time to live. And I've seen people die in the last days of their life, at least, healed in a way that they had never been healed in the time I knew them before that. I've seen people at the times of getting close to death try to attempt healing. It seems such an important thing to do. I've seen people try to reconcile themselves and heal relationships with important people that they love. And sometimes they're successful, and it's quite beautiful to see. Sometimes people are maybe embarrassed or shy or afraid to say, "I love you." Or they think there's plenty of time to say it, so we'll get around to it later when there's a better time. And then when they're dying, the things that need to be said like that are said, and it's quite beautiful to see the connection, the healed connection, the heartfelt connection that can happen. Stephen Levine talks about people who die and feeling that their life is complete, or feeling some, not enough their life is complete, but feeling a sense of completeness, feeling that it's just enough to be present, and they don't feel like something is undone or unfinished. And there's a lot of projects, of course, that some people have that they want to do, and trips they want to make, and whatever. But a lot of things like that are relatively superficial. And when they fall away, for example, at times of getting close to death, the deeper meanings of our life, the deeper things that have value for us stand out. And then if we're at odds with ourselves, if we're at war with ourselves or distressed about something or feel incomplete, then the call to try to come to completion becomes quite strong. And the beautiful thing is that the inner completion of the psyche, of the heart, of the body-mind doesn't require doing anything. It doesn't require writing a book. It doesn't require, you know, going on a trip. It doesn't require, you know, because in a sense, it's already there. It's something all within us. And so it's a matter of, I like the expression coming home, being at home deeply with ourselves. So how is it that breathing can do the same thing? It's one thing to be up against, you know, moments of our dying and to be motivated to heal. But how is it that something as simple as breathing can bring healing? To take a breather. Sometimes we wish the whole world would take a breather right now. Wouldn't it be nice? And it's quite amazing to me the degree to which the breath is connected to so many different aspects of our life. It's connected to our external life because we depend on the whole ecology of plants and life in the world to produce the oxygen that keeps us going. I went a few days ago with my family to the Pinnacles National Park, and they listed there in the brochure, although, you know, it's a national park or preserve or state park, I guess, I don't know. But they're there kind of preserving nature there. And they're very proud, the brochure, of what they're preserving. But one of the things they listed that they're preserving was class 1A air. I never heard of, you know, national preserves of air, you know. But here we're going to keep the smog out. And so the breath certainly connects us to the natural world. And myself, at times in my life, I felt a phenomenal connection in that awareness of how the breath connects me with the world and with plants and nature and sustains my life. But also the breath connects us to the inner world of our body and our minds, our emotions. And many people have commented about how the process of breathing, the mechanical process of breathing, is much more than a mechanical process, but is intimately tied to our intentions, our reactions, our feelings, our emotions, our ideas about life. And we can see it most clearly in the flight, fight kind of response, that when we get geared up for fight or flight, that it affects the way we hold our torso, hold our breath. We might hold ourselves tight and breathe kind of shallowly or breathe in a different way than when we relax because we're prepared to fight. We're prepared for sudden action, running away. And it's also been pointed out how that response of fear and flight is something that doesn't require, you know, the mountain lion suddenly appearing. It doesn't require some real threat that's immediate, but it's something that happens when our ego is threatened, when our ideas are threatened, when our fantasies are what's going to happen. So get threatened. And so many people that go around in a chronic stage state where somehow they're contracted or tight around their breathing. And I do that still. And it's quite amazing to me still that how important sitting down to meditate is for me, or going for a run or some other ways of freeing up my breath. Because if I spend a whole day running around, even doing relatively mild and uninteresting tasks, and if I get caught up in kind of trying to fulfill them all quickly as I can so I can get onto the more important things of life, then and I'm not paying attention to what I'm doing, I'll find by the end of the day, I'll find that there's a kind of a band of tightness, mild band of tightness across my chest, or my shoulders feel a little bit tense. And so the sitting then, the end of the day, is a way of certainly revealing that. And then as I breathe into it and breathe with it, the tension or the contraction that holds the chest there, the shoulders there, begins to unravel and fade away. There are times when my shoulders, for example, actually feel achy from the way I've been holding them all day or some time. And the first response that I might have, I can imagine a person having, would be running away from that, avoiding it. Why should I sit there and feel this discomfort in my body? Why don't I just, if I can sit in the couch and slouch and watch television, I'm not going to feel anything in my shoulders then. So why don't we just, forget about this meditation? It's uncomfortable. Let's go do something which I don't have to feel it. The problem with that is if you don't have to feel it, tendency is shoulders, don't relax deeply, but rather stay tense, maybe tense up more. So I sit there on the couch slouching, watching CNN, the images from CNN. And, and then not only my shoulders are, but then my stomach's in knots. It's much better to sit there in meditation and face what our karma is, face what is going on with us. Because then the chances are is that not only as we face it, we're not adding to it. And then it can begin to relax and soften. So a lot of our ways in which we respond to the world and react to the world are embedded in the way that we breathe. And so as we begin breathing mindfully and becoming aware of the breath, we start feeling what's going on with more than just our physical breath, but our emotions, our reactions, what's going on in our life. It's a way of taking stock of what's happening. I suppose that some people hold their attention more in the areas of their breath than other people do, so maybe some of this doesn't apply to everyone. But the breath is somewhere in the torso that breathes is where a lot of people can have a certain kind of holding. What's interesting is that all kinds of fears and aversions and attitudes in the mind, even exciting, happy ones, joyful ones, can involve a kind of fixating of the mind. We fixate the mind. The mind gets attached to some preoccupation. And I've seen over and over again in myself that when I'm preoccupied in my mind, fixated with my mind, there tends to be a corresponding fixation in my body somewhere. And often enough, a corresponding fixation somewhere in the way that I breathe. When I turn the attention back to breathing mindfully, it becomes like a lubricant that softens and relaxes slowly, not immediately. I have to kind of stay there with it, stay with the aching or the discomfort or the tension that might be there with the breath, and stay with it, be aware of it, be mindful of it. And slowly, it begins to loosen and unravel until finally the breath is loose and it feels really want to have a really loose and comfortable breath that seems to breathe itself. I think it's one of the great, wonderful experiences of life. I had the first encounter with that that I really was aware of when I was 20. Imagine that. I didn't really learn how to breathe until I was 20. I wasn't meditating that much at that point, but I was living for about 6 months on a small farm and spending a lot of time outdoors and doing a lot of physical work and no access to media or television and kind of very isolated kind of valley and just not much going on there except milking those cows and cutting the hay and bringing it in for the winter. And I remember walking across the fields one day early in the morning to go get the cows and feeling my breathing and feeling, wow, I've learned how to breathe. I felt so at home or complete or so like the breathing was deeply meaningful. Just to breathe was meaningful. And just to it's phenomenal. Like just to breathe was enough. Just to breathe was, fulfilled my life. It fulfilled life at that moment. Life felt complete in that moment. And I was very glad for that experience, and for those kinds of experiences that I've had since then, because it's a corrective, or a balance, counterbalance, to the momentum in our mind, certainly in my mind, of I think I'll only be fulfilled in my life if I can finish that project, write that article or that book or do this or that, or and then until I get geared up and see as soon as I get geared up, right, then suddenly the breath has kind of changed a little bit, and to find out you can feel fulfilled, this magic thing, just by the way the breath is in some way. Why is that? What does it mean to be healed? What does it mean to feel complete in your life? What is it to feel there's meaning in your life? Does meaning have to come from some thing that you do? Or it could it be something innate in who we are when things are settled and at ease? So I know a lot of people are not settled and at ease, both this week and also in other ways in their lives. And people come to meditation practice in order to find that, in order to cope or to deal with their difficulties or suffering. It's been said in ancient times that no one comes to Buddhism except through suffering. And maybe we could argue that's the case. There are people who seem to come to Buddhism without the idea that they're suffering, but then you could argue, well, they don't know it. So I don't want to push the point, so when people come, with their anxieties. You know, the word anxiety is supposed to come from a Greek word to choke. So again, connected to our breathing. There was this beautiful thing that a friend of mine told me last week. This friend of mine who came back from Thailand, living there for 6 months. And she said it was a very common saying there among people in general, but in particular it was struck her when the teachers told her this, Buddhist teachers. And the expression that she conveyed it to me was, oh, it's normal. And the idea things are just normal. And she said she would go to her teacher and talk about, her greed. I'm just filled with greed or something. And the teacher would just laugh and say, oh, it's normal. I'm really angry. Oh, it's normal. And as opposed to, that's bizarre, you're weird, you shouldn't be doing that, and you should be ashamed of yourself, and how could you admit that to me, and all these things that voices we internalize in ourselves when we have these strange impulses and desires and feelings sometimes, and we don't admit it, or we don't feel like it's normal, we feel like we're strange, and oh, it's normal to be this way, it's normal to be neurotic, or anxious, or whatever. And I just love that expression, and it's normal. It's a little bit different than saying, oh, please accept yourself. Because somehow that's maybe a little bit pejorative even. Just accept yourself for being such a neurotic person. But it's normal, And the teacher is just kind of very accepting, very happy to see you. And your happiness in seeing, doesn't change because you just confessed how horrible you are. Now, I've seen in some Theravadan Buddhists, a certain kind of bittersweet quality in this kind of, oh, it's normal. Because, the bitter part is that it's kind of built into human beings to be distressed and to have evil and difficulties and anger and all these terrible things. So to say it's normal is to recognize both the bitter and sweet. But, it's normal to be that way. And then Dharma practice, meditation practice, is built on this foundation, oh, it's normal. But let's see what we can do about it. Let's see if we can improve ourselves. Let's see if we can relax in a deeper way, let go some deeper way. So it turns out that breathing, mindfulness of breathing, is one of the great ways human beings can learn to let go. And it works a little bit this way, that if you're trying to stay with your breathing, which can be very difficult to do, but if you're trying to stay with your breathing, you'll notice sooner or later how easily your mind gets swept up in other concerns, other preoccupations, other feelings. And often, like there's a Velcro between, your mind and your preoccupation, or magnets, And you say, wow, staying with my breath, and how did I get over there? I was hit breath one moment and you didn't even notice the transition. And suddenly, 5 minutes later, it's occurred. And what happened? How did I get there? But the strength of a preoccupation has a lot to do with the strength of the way in which we're attached or holding on. And to come back to the breathing is to some degree to let go of our preoccupation, of our fixation. And it might be 10,000 times in the course of a meditation you have to let go because the magnet just worked, you're there. And you let go, and you let go, and you let go. And that letting go begins to slowly loosen the hand of our clenching or resistance to how things are. And so it's kind of a massage. It's kind of a reconditioning that happens when we let go. And in a sense, it doesn't really matter how long you stay with your breath. It's very useful to stay with your breath, but it's very powerful to over and over again be dedicated to, I'll let go. No matter what arises in my psyche, I'll let go of it. I'll let go of it. I'll let go of it. And really become adept at being able to let go. And this is a little bit kind of my own personal analysis, which maybe doesn't work so well, but I'll offer it to you anyway. As a person stays with the breath, tries to keep the attention with the breathing, the first thing is kind of like the first thing that kind of takes us away might be the surface chatter of our day. Say that you're really thinking a lot about what you're going to make for dinner tonight. And you're really concerned about that. Maybe you're having guests and it's really important to impress them. And whatever. And so you're caught up in the idea of what's going to happen for dinner today. So you come here and you're thinking of those thoughts. You sit down to meditate. And if you don't do anything else but sit down, then those thoughts will probably continue. But you've been told, or you've learned, that it's useful to be with your breath. So you focus on your breath, and you notice your mind keeps going off into planning dinner kind of thoughts. It's relatively superficial, and you can let go of it. You can let go of it. And after you let go of it well enough, you have a little more determination to stay with the breath. You can maybe stay with more than 3 breaths. Now you can stay maybe with 7 breaths in a row. And planning your menu thoughts don't come back. But then a deeper layer of thoughts, which have a deeper kind of, we're more deeply attached to it, greater kind of fixation in our minds about, might begin surfacing. Maybe now it's not so much what we're going to have for dinner, but rather now maybe it's the thoughts around, oh, it's really important these guests who come tonight, it's really important for me that they like me, they feel comfortable. And so we feel the attachment there. So we can get to 7 breaths until that begins to appear. It's a deeper kind of fixation, attachment. And so we let go of that, we stay with the breath, we work through that. And now we can stay to 9 breaths in a row. But now there's some deeper, this kind of subterranean attachment that shows itself. It wouldn't have showed itself if we just stayed thinking about menus all the time. And then we work through that, we breathe with that, and it's hard to breathe through it. And then you go, maybe now you can go maybe 15 breaths in a row without the mind leaving the breath. And the mind gets quieter, perhaps, but then some deeper, quieter, deeper underlying strata of attachment that we're maybe only aware of once in a great while shows itself. We work through that. And then we're able to stay with the breath maybe 30 breaths in a row. I don't know what the right number should be in this analogy, right? I'm just making something up here. But and then something deeper shows itself that's much more tenacious. So what I'm arguing here is that as we get more and more concentrated on the breath, the function of concentration tends to reveal deeper and deeper and more tenacious levels of holding in our psyche. And the practice is still the same in all situations. Continue coming back to the breath, continue letting go, try to develop and cultivate your concentration, try to develop a stronger, trying to develop a strength of staying with the breath so you have a counterweight to the strength of your preoccupations. And the more you do that, the more you'll plunge deeply into your psyche, deeply into aspects of who you are that you wouldn't even dream about, that you have, or that they're part of who you are in your normal kind of street consciousness when you're involved in the equivalent of planning for dinner. And sometimes it can get quite difficult to be aware of those parts. But sometimes it's also can be extremely beautiful. And I think a lot of people who go around in surface chatter of their mind, surface concerns of their mind, don't have a clue how the incredible degree of beauty that resides inside of each of us. The beauty, for example, when I was walking across that field at age 20 and feeling my breath breathe itself and feeling complete and feeling my life, all the meaning of life was found right then. And I wasn't even trying anything. It just arose. That's a kind of a beauty, a beautiful state to be in. As we feel comfortable, when we're comfortable down there in the core of our being, that becomes a beautiful state, a beautiful experience, a beautiful radiance within us. So to breathe, to stay with the breath, And let the alternating breathing in and breathing out be like a lubricant, be like a massage. The massage is the ways in which, where the tensions are in the body. The massage is the tensions of the mind, the fears of the mind, the hates of the mind. And so they can begin softening and relaxing so we're not fixated. Now I know that there can be a strong argument to be made within our own minds that we have more important things to do with our minds than concentrate on the breath. We have more important things to do in our minds than become calm and settled and relaxed. There's wars to be fought or wars to be protested. There's, you know, both externally and internally. There's all these things that need to be done. We need to worry. It's really important to worry, you know. Yeah, last night my wife told my son, he has a little cyst on his cheek. And we thought it was a pimple. And it stayed for about 6 months or so. And so finally went to the doctor, and the doctor said, it was a cyst, and don't worry about it. But because we went to the doctor, now he was worrying a little bit about it. And he hadn't worried about it before. So he asked last night, you know, what about this, you know, cyst that I have here? So my wife said, the doctor said it's nothing, just cyst, nothing to worry about. And he said, well, what if it's something more? What if it's something else or something? And my wife said to him, well, you could worry about it if you want. If you like worrying, you can worry all you want. And then he broke into a smile and laughed, and that was the end of it. So if you like to worry, you can. But sometimes there can be this argument in the head, oh, it's important to worry. Because that's how you take care of yourself. That's how you protect yourself. That's how you protect your friends. Or that's how you show that you love them or that you care. You know. But is there ever a time where it's useful to sacrifice your inner calm for worry? Has worry ever done anybody any good? And you might say, well, it helped me get prepared. So I got prepared for what was going to happen. But my argument in return would be that there are better ways to be prepared than having to worry. That if you stay calm, you can find the motivation within calmness to have concern and to take the steps that need to be taken to be prepared or do X, Y, and Z, whatever needs to be done. But there's no need to be worried. So I know it's hard not to worry. I'm not saying it's easy to let go of worry. What I'm trying to get across here is that be very careful to that voice inside your head that somehow tells you it's more important than to worry, you have to worry, than it is to allow yourself to become calm. And one of the things I believe we can do, or we are doing in Dharma practice, is we're learning a capacity, we're learning to trust our capacity to respond to life in wise, effective ways while we stay calm. And I think that takes a lot of trust. To stay calm, to stay at ease, to keep your belly relaxed, soft, to breathe freely. And not feel like you have to sacrifice or give up that in order to be effectively respond to situations of the world. And I would like to suggest that you experiment with this and find out for yourself whether you cannot actually take care of things quite effectively by staying calm. You can even do things fast while you're calm. You don't have to worry to do, you know, if suddenly you have this idea, I have to do things quickly in order to get, you know, these things fulfilled. Well, that doesn't mean you have to worry. Just do it quickly. So learning how to trust our capacity to respond from our calm. And it can be said a little bit, perhaps more deeply, to trust our innate intelligence. To trust our innate intelligence. If we rest in awareness, if we rest in our body, if we rest in our breath, to trust the innate intelligence that comes out of there, that tells us what to do, that prompts us. But certainly not at the expense of getting tense. Do we sacrifice our well-being by getting tense in some way, by being afraid? So mindfulness of breathing is very challenging. You know, it's such a simple idea. Bring your attention to your breath and stay with it. Breathe mindfully in and out. But it really challenges, can challenge so many of the fundamentally core ways in which we orient ourselves to life. The core ways in which we attach to life, we fixate. Core ways in which we're afraid of life. Core ways in which we defend ourselves or resist things. Something as simple as breathing mindfully over and over again. Because if you fully enter the world of the breath, if you're there completely, if you kind of offer yourself over to your breath totally and have some concentration there with the breath, ultimately, you cannot be attached to anything else. It's simply not possible to do that. So as you offer yourself to the breath, in order to do it well, you have to let go of all those attachments as you get stiller and stiller. Another way of understanding all this is that as you get more and more concentrated, the psyche gets stiller and stiller and more relaxed. Our attachments, the ways in which the mind clings and resists, is afraid, hates, are all activities of the mind that are different than a stillness. And they're all actions which are tense and are different than relaxed. So as through concentration and mindfulness we get more and more relaxed and still, we either have to let go of places of tightness and activity, or we have to really see it clearly for what it is. And then hopefully have the attitude, oh, it's normal. It's okay. And then practice with it. Don't give into it because it's normal. But don't be at war with it either. So how do you practice with the breath? There are many, 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 many different breath techniques, breath meditation techniques, many ways. I forgot to say this at the beginning of the talk. I was going to ask you to listen to the talk through your breathing. Stay connected to your breathing as I give this talk. And then as if you're breathing, your breath body has ears. Listen through those ears. Listen through your breath. And trust your innate capacity to take in what needs to be taken in if you're relaxed. I've had wonderful... I used to listen to Dharma talks a lot. I used to be with my breath. I sit and meditate during a Dharma talk. I would hardly ever look at the speaker. It's a little bit hard for the speaker if no one ever looks at you when they're giving. In the Zen circles, you know, if I give talks at the Zen Center, most of the people look down, you know, their eyes, they're meditating like we were, like I did when I was a Zen student. And it's very nice, if you're used to getting people looking at you and, you know, nodding their heads or whatever, getting feedback, it's a little bit odd, you know. But it's really great. It's really great. I actually recommend it. It's really great to sit there and continue meditating during a talk and listen through your body, listen through the breath. And I've gotten very concentrated on my breathing, listening to some teachers talk, very still in that process. So anyway, it's kind of almost over now, but... for the last few couple of minutes that I have, you might try that. Try being with your breathing. So there are many ways of being with your breath, and one of the things to do as a meditator is to find where in your body it works best for you to connect to your breathing, and maybe to experiment a little bit to find out where it's easiest to keep the mind attached to the breath. To be for some people. It tends to be the belly. And there are some teachers who actually strongly encourage meditators to be aware of the breath in the belly. For one reason is it's easier if you're paying attention to the rising and falling of the abdomen to help keep the belly relaxed. I spent years of my Zen practice learning how to keep my belly relaxed when I meditated because it was always tense. And that's one place to feel it. But also kind of feeling it low is kind of helps with low center of gravity, which can be relaxing. Some people prefer to feel the breath in their chest, rising and falling in the chest. Some people occasionally be aware of the breath, the air going in and out the back of their throat. Or some people feel it around the tip of their nostrils, the air going in and out, the sensations of the air passing across the nostrils. And Different places work for different people. And to find where it works for you, the easiest, most comforting. Sometimes it's as we get more concentrated, the location where the breath is most pronounced changes. And so you might, like for example, for me, I start down here in my belly usually. And then as I get more concentrated, there's a way in which the breath begins going, where I'm aware of the breath goes up into my chest. And then I might be aware of the center of my chest for a while. Once you know, another way of doing the breath is not to be connected to one particular place, but rather to feel the whole breath body. You know, there's just so much happens in the body as you breathe. The way the body responds and is moved by the breathing. It's not only the front rib cages, but the back rib cage, the shoulder blades, the shoulders, the belly, down deep down into your abdomen. There's all sensations, you know, movement and pressure and release of pressure and expansion, contraction, all over the body. And they kind of have a global sense of the body breathing, like bellows. For some people, it's a very comforting, very helpful way of staying connected to the breath. Whichever way it is, once you've established some connection with your breathing, you really want to try to maintain a connection there so the mind doesn't slip off. Some people are very good of connecting to the breath, but they don't have much ability to sustain the attention once they've connected to it. So they connect with the breath, the mind goes off the breath, then they reconnect, the mind wanders away, they reconnect. But connecting and sustaining are two different functions of the mind. And you also want to be able to sustain the attention on the breathing. For a while in my own practice, I used an image. And maybe it's not a very good Buddhist image, but I had the image of fishing. And, you know, I haven't done a lot of fishing, but what I understand is that you cast out and you catch this big fish. Like, it's a really big fish, right? I never caught a big fish, but, you know, really big, big ocean fish, right? So the way you reel it in is you keep the fishing wire always taut. And if the big fish pulls away really hard, then you have to give line. But you always keep it taut, because if you don't keep it taut, it becomes loose. Then the hook could get loose from inside the mouth, and the fish can get free, which we all hope for. But you know, if you keep it taut, then the hook is stuck and it can't get out. And then when the fish swims towards you, you want to pull in to keep it taut also. So I used that image for a while with my breath meditation. I would like hook my attention onto some place here in my belly. And then as the belly went in and out, I would keep that line of awareness taut as the fish went away and as the fish came back. Keeping it taut, keeping it connected. And just stay there. And that image helped me stay connected. That's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is just not use an image at all, but just because you're dedicated, you say, okay, find some place, some sensation in your body where you feel the breath, like in the belly or the chest or someplace, and then just be dedicated to stay riding that sensation. You're going to ride it. You're going to ride it, back and forth, ride it. And really stay to sustain the attention. I've known people who use the image of, one woman I know who used the image of, she imagined herself as an eagle soaring on the wind currents. And she imagined she was soaring on the sensations of the breath that she was, you know, so that the image of soaring kept her connected really well. If you use imagery like that, sooner or later you have to let go of the imagery, because it actually keeps you a little bit disconnected from the immediacy of the experience. But if initially it helps you get concentrated, it can be really helpful to do that. I find it very helpful to count the breath. And still to this day, I count the breath. If I feel my mind has a mind of its own, if it's really concentrated, if it's really scattered, and I sit down to meditate, and just, you know, I can't seem to stay present. And then I'll count the breath for a while. And that helps me kind of get lined up on the breath, settles myself. The routine of counting the breath, of being with the breath one after the other, keeping track of the counts, is focusing of the mind. And counting, and then once I get more concentrated and I can stay with the breath without counting, then I let go of the counting and just continue with mindfulness of breathing. So a concentrated state is very healing. It's healing because it helps us let go of all the forces that keep us scattered and fractured and preoccupied and afraid and resisting and defended. And it's also very healing because a concentrated state in and of itself feels really wholesome. And to feel the wholesomeness of a concentrated state, there are times when I get really concentrated where I feel this healing energy coursing through my body. It feels very healing to the whole body, mind. Physically healing. It's almost like there's like in my blood, there's healing particles and they're just kind of moving through all my body. It's a vibration. Kind of feeling of wholeness, feeling of connectedness, feeling of being integrated, harmonious feeling, to be at harmony with oneself. These are all kind of descriptions of what a concentrated state might can be like. So, there are many reasons why people need healing, but meditation is a healing act. And I hope that any of you who might feel the need for healing, healing your anger, or healing your fear, or healing your distress, that you think about breathing mindfully, being with your breath. And model to the world, to your friends, your family, your neighbors, your presidents, the effectiveness of responding to the cries of the world from a place of being calm and at home with oneself. Because I think the world needs the example of people who know how to do that. Well, thank you. I'm sorry that I took the whole time up talking. I was hoping to have questions and discussion. And I wish you all well. And I'll be here next week when Tanjeff gives a talk, and I'll be back to give a talk in 2 weeks.